The time attendance at state parks is up, and in order to close the state's $9 billion deficit, Governor Patterson proposed huge cuts in funding, which would have closed 41 parks and 14 historic sites.
The operating budget for this fiscal year is $186 million. That's down $29 million from last year, but Albany did restore about $11 million of that, saving the parks from closing.
So just how big is the New York State park system? Well, there are 178 parks and 35 historic sites. That includes 21 golf courses, some of them ranked among the best public courses in the world, in fact. They encompass 325,000 acres and have 55 million visitors a year.
So what should be done with the parks? Should they remain public, or should the state hire private companies to run them? We took that question to Riverbank State Park in Upper Manhattan to see what you think.
I think it's working fine now, and why change it?
The basketball program that they have on Sundays is great for my son. And it's just always a nice, cool, you know, environment to be in.
I think it's like one of the best parts of the city. I mean, I really like this area. I wouldn't have anything against it, you know. I don't think there's a downside to it, really.
Well, everyone has an opinion on that one, and joining us right now to talk more about this issue, Leonard Gilroy, Director of Government Reform at the Reason Foundation. That's a nonprofit think tank. Leonard, you're in favor of privatization public parks. Tell us why.
Well, cash-strapped state and local governments like those in New York State should take every opportunity to streamline and tap private sector experience and expertise wherever possible. And one of the areas in which we've seen a lot of interest and activity is in privatization and public-private partnerships in parks. And there are a couple reasons for that. One, the private sector can drive down cost, the cost of operation. Just even on simple outsourcing and maintenance-type activities, they can save anywhere between 20 to 50%. But beyond that, what the more robust models of privatization can actually increase revenue to the state.
We want to bring in Jeffrey Croft right now, the New York City Park Advocates. That's a nonprofit watchdog group dedicated to improving the lives of city residents by making its parks open, better places for you to stay and live and examine. Now, Jeffrey, you disagree. Do you think that parks should remain public? What's your view on that?
Well, over the last 30 years, our experience, these public-private partnerships have created an enormous disparity, the gaps between the have and the have-nots, while ignoring the real problem, which is our parks are not funded as an essential city service. And that is a huge issue. So we have these organizations throughout the city who have created these little mini parks departments, but there's very little accountability, and there's a tremendous, tremendous pushback here in New York City.
All right. Now, Jeff, let me ask you this. The parks are for everyone, but not everyone really seems to use them. Now, in these tough times, should everyone be forced to foot the bill?
Well, everyone does use them. If you breathe in New York City, the vast majority, in fact, every single tree, unless it's in your backyard, is under the purview of one of our three parks departments.
States are put in the position of actually having to make tough budget decisions, and out of that, we're seeing a number of states talking about closing state parks entirely. And the same thing is happening at the urban level. And so some states are looking at, well, is there an opportunity to perhaps partner with the private sector to keep these open, not only to keep them open, but turn them from revenue-losing parks that are subsidized by taxpayers, but actually turning them into revenue-generating assets for the state. And under strict operating conditions, so, you know, you may hear myths about things like losing control of the parks if we turn them over to privatization, but I would argue it's the exact opposite. These folks are working under contracts, typically with state and local park authorities, at federal as well, and these contracts specify every little what if and, you know, every condition, covering things like user fees, maintenance of the parks, and really how
Jeff,
the park
you're standing by. I know you want to say something. Go ahead.
One of the problems here, like you take a park like Bryant Park, for many months of the year, the Oasis, the Green Oasis, is actually off limits because they rent that out to a fashion show and other events. So it's actually preventing the public. Right here in New York City, in Mayor Bloomberg every year has a private picnic that for over a dozen acres of parkland for over 3 weeks, the public is actually denied access to land on Randall's Island. This
All
is
right.
public parkland.
I want to raise another possible solution, gentlemen. Let's take a look at what New York City did with Central Park. After years of neglect and poor management in the 70s, you recall, New York City went in a very different direction, working with the private sector. Now, in 1980, it formed the Central Park Conservancy. It's responsible for the day-to-day maintenance and operation of the park. The Conservancy provides 85% of Central Park's $25 million annual budget through fundraising investment revenue. It is a success story. Jeff, could this work for the state?
Well, no, not at all. And that issue has been raised. One of the problems is that the wealthiest people in the world live around Central Park. And in New York City, 99% of the people do not live around a park like Central Park. So again, that's great that wealthy people have their park and their backyards. But New York City, everyone depends upon their parks as their backyard.
Leonard, do you want to quickly respond to that?
Well, I'd argue that with the privatization and the partnerships in New York City, both Central Park, Bryant Park are good examples, what you've done is really turned around decrepit parks that were falling apart, literally, under government operation, and you've turned them into largely self-sustaining enterprises or very close to it, where the city's obligation in terms of taxpayer expenditures in those parks is minimized, and those parks are thriving today. You go to Bryant Park or Central Park, you see these things are well used, and you see that, for instance, in Bryant Park, since the private sector took over, the budget has increased 20 times, and that's not on the city's dime. That's on collecting private donations.
It actually is
and tapping,
on
it, private
Leonard,
sector.
It actually is on the city's dime because they, unlike 99.9% of the city parks here, they get to keep their concession revenue in a behind-closed-door deal that allows that park to keep their revenue.
I will challenge you on that, and what I would say is that you should look at how the state park, or excuse me, the U.S. Forest Service districts and the recreation facilities there, like for instance in my home state of Arizona, all of them are concessioned out. Mm-hmm. You go and stay at a campground in a U.S. Forest Service campground in Arizona, you're staying at a concession campground where the operator is collecting user fees from the gate and is actually paying the federal government back some portion of those revenues back and taking the costs off the taking costs off the state books.
Again,
and so urban parks are a lot different from state parks.
They are very, very, very different. And again, we don't have campgrounds to support those type of user fees. And again, there's tremendous pushback here. And also, there's a level of accountability here with all these different groups
setting
up these nonprofits.
Great subject, great debate going here. It affects a lot of people, of course, and we're going to have to leave it right there for now. Leonard Gilroy, Jeffrey Croft, thank you very much for joining us for a very spirited conversation tonight. Thank you very much.